Okay, so this morning's lecture is on Catholics in Protestant Europe. I'm sorry, my voice is still a little hoarse. I'm getting over a cold. So, you've probably picked up in your reading a key theme when we're talking about Protestant states, Catholic states, and majority and minority religions in early modern Europe is the theme of confessionalization, which I thought I should probably mention. Confessionalization is a theory that was developed by German historians Heinz Schilling and Wolfgang Reinhardt in the 1970s to 80s, just before I was born, really. With reference to the history of Germany. And in a way, it was a way of rescuing, as it were, the history of religion, of early modern religion, from being a bit of a niche by itself that was dominated by historians from particular denominational backgrounds, tracing the history of their particular denomination, and to try and explain it as a force in the wider currents of history, and at that time German historical study was very dominated by notions of political history, state formation, and things like that. So they developed this idea of religion, particularly as a religion defined against competing religions, as being a force in the formation of nation states in the early modern period. And gradually, of course, the notion of confessionalization was developed and adapted so that it could take in not only the notion of like rulers' agendas, which combined state formation with religion and promoting and embedding of the favoured religion, but also wider cultural processes of how denominate particular confessions could become enculturated and widespread, and a means of identifying, you know, both us and them. So it's a way of mapping how individuals, as well as communities, came to identify themselves as a particular Christian confession, both as a confession and against other confessions. Later works on confessionalization also adapted and expanded this theory to apply it beyond Germany, and also even to some extent beyond Christianity. People have asked, can we talk about confessionalization in the Ottoman Empire, for example? But the theory, I mean, it's been debated whether the concept as originally defined can really be applied anywhere beyond Germany, but I think the argument is that it can, if it's adaptable, it's flexible. Something that we can usefully call confessionalization can help us to understand places and cultures other than early modern Germany. I'm not sure there's an official definition of confessional state, but broadly speaking, we might say... Oh, it's on earlier than I wanted it. Oh, why is it going forward? That's right. As a confessional state is one in which one particular religion is officially that of the nation, however defined, and other religions are to some degree treated as alien to that state. Most states in Europe at this time are confessional states of one sort or another. It's been suggested that one way of understanding the Reformation is to understand it as being the fragmentation of Christendom. And, you know, that idea has its limitations and qualifications, but it's not unuseful, and I think it reflects a certain contemporary perception, certainly among Catholics, that what was happening was Christendom being fragmented, torn up, at war with itself. And there was almost a sort of cultural trauma, really, sparked by that perception. The image on here is a work that was written by a chap called Richard Verstegen or Rowlands He was born of Dutch ancestry in London in the earlier 16th century, so 1530, I think. And he was a Catholic, and he later went into exile in Antwerp. Well, first he was in Paris with it, and then in Antwerp. Once he settled in the Low Countries, in the Spanish-dominated part of the Low Countries, he sort of reverted to his ancestral name as Verstegen. But he remained, for most of the rest of his life, very strongly connected to English Catholicism. And his Theatrum Crudelitatis Hereticorum Nostri Temporis means a spectacle of the cruelty of the heretics of our age. And I suppose the point of it, I mean, obviously this is Catholic. He is interested in Protestant violence against Catholics. He's not really interested in portraying Catholic violence against Protestants, of which there was plenty. But the point here is this book, which relies on both word and image, and you can see that the images have little sort of letters at various points. You might not be able to see them on this. There's an A there, and a B there, C, and then there'll be, you can't see it on this page, it's the other side of the page, there'll be little text that's point out. Point C in the image is showing you this. Point A is showing you this. So it's a work that combines text and image, and crucially, it combines different parts of Europe, different locations of this struggle between Catholicism and heresy. Part one is about Henry VIII of England, his schism from the Pope, his separation from the Pope, and his consequent persecution of Catholics. Then you have a part where they show the Catholic victims of the Dutch Protestants who were in a revolt against the rulers of the Netherlands, more on that later. And then he has a section where he shows Catholic victims of French Protestants. And then finally he goes back to England and he shows the persecution of Catholicism by Elizabeth. And so the point is that Verstegen is kind of selling, as it were, the persecution in England as being part of a single paradigm of heretic violence. And, you know, the fight for survival in England is strongly linked to these civil wars going on in France and Holland. And it's, it's a sense of, first of all, if Protestants get control of France or of the Netherlands, the kind of this is your future. And secondly, to link them, the success in one place is essential to success in another place. The picture itself shows something. I mean, I can't vouch for the historical, like what his sources were for this particular incident. But what he's showing here is that the Protestant soldiers are specifically targeting priests, which they tended to do. They targeted Catholic priests and Catholic religion because they were, to the Protestant soldiers, emblematic of Catholicism. And in this instance, they also, of course, had a big thing against religious images, which they regarded as idolatrous. So what Verstegen is showing here is this, that they've allegedly sort of tied the priest, the living priest, to the statue of Jesus on the crucifix, and then they're killing him, they're firing muskets at him, hence the clouds of smoke. So he's showing this kind of linking of vengefulness against priests with their hatred of religious images. And of course, while Protestants saw the destruction of a crucifix as the destruction of an idol, which is getting in the way of people's genuine faith in Christ, to Catholics, it's just like, well, look, come on, you hunt down images of Christ and destroy them. You know, what does that say? How can this be anything but an attack on Christ if you hate his image? Okay, so, of course, Verstegen's work is a martyrology. It's a work about martyrs, Catholic martyrs. Martyrdom had a big resurgence in early modern Europe. It did not really, because Christianity had been in a position of dominance, it hadn't been a big thing in most of Western Europe for some centuries. But there were obviously, because of the religious conflicts of the early modern period, there was a huge resurgence in the numbers of people who were dying for their beliefs and being killed for their beliefs. Even though was, you know, people would be quick to point out there had been executions, you know, of unorthodox, you know, of heretics by Catholic states during the Middle Ages, but there's no denying that there was a big upsurge in numbers and in the cultural importance of martyrdom. Now, a martyr, as many people know, means a witness, right? And a witness, that is, to the truth. The sort of notion is that, you know, dating back to the very earliest Christians who were executed for their beliefs during the mostly during the Roman Empire, is that the person, essentially, if someone believes these things so strongly that they would rather die than say that they don't believe them, then that is supposed to convey to people who see this that, you know, there must be something in it, basically. If it's so important to him, surely there must be something in it. This must be worth a further look. There was also the witness of virtue, that if martyrs came across as incredibly brave and also incredibly charitable and forgiving and prayerful and so on, that then again it would be like, well, if this religion makes people behave in this exemplary, admirable way, there must be something in it. So the problem is, of course, what happens when someone dies witnessing to what you think is a false belief? What happens to the witness then? Because they're saying that, because then, you know, well, people might conclude from that that the false belief must have something in it, because, you know, she's willing to die rather than give it up. So what do you call someone whose death appears to promote a false belief? And the word they came up with, and it sounds like really horrible to us today, but it was used all the time, was pseudo-martyr, a false martyr, a false witness. And there was nearly as much ink spilt on the pseudo-martyr as martyr literature, and sometimes indeed they are combined. You'll have in the same work, a writer will be sort of praising martyrs who share his beliefs, and at the same time trying to deconstruct martyrs of an opposing belief and show that they're not really a good witness at all. And in some ways, this is a very specific early modern Christian problem. But in other ways, it's just an example of the chronic problem, which is, what do you do about the enemy's heroes? You see your heroes of your cause as somehow bolstering and validating your cause. But the enemy has heroes too. And it happens all the time in ideological conflicts of all sorts, in wars of all sorts, even in politics, even on a very petty level. You know, in politics today, whenever they get criticised very heavily in the social media for something that they say, and if that person's on your side, then they've been unjustly attacked, and they're very, very brave to have said what they said, and so on. But quite often, the very same people, if it's someone on the other side of the political divide, you know, getting attacked, they'll just pile on and say, well, he obviously deserved it. It's quite right that social media should call people out. You know, you just watch the different ways that people react to people they agree with suffering in some way, and people they disagree with suffering in some way on account of their beliefs of whatever nature. It's always a problem. What do you do with the enemy's heroes? And this is why, after Brad Gregory's kind of seminal work, Salvation at Stake, which analysed the various Christian martyr traditions of early modern Europe in parallel, after all his sort of 300 pages of how people defined martyrs and how they defined pseudo-martyrs and how they tried to differentiate between the two, he ended up saying, basically, in the end, on this topic, early modern Christians did not debate, they just disagreed. Because in the end, the martyr's a martyr if they agree with you, and they're not a martyr if they disagree with you. I recommend Brad Gregory's book, though. It's very fascinating. Like, it's got some very good material and very good analysis of the pseudo-martyr literature. So, some Protestant states in Europe. We're not going to talk about all these in detail. I'm going to end up focusing on mostly on England and a bit on the Dutch Republic and Holland, because those two were probably the most important states in Europe that, that turned Protestant. So in Scandinavia, the Reformation, the Scandinavian kingdoms, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, they're not separate polities at this time. Denmark, for various political reasons, history that I don't need to go into, but Denmark was ruling Norway under a single king, and hence also territories like Iceland. Sweden had broken away from Danish control, so it's a separate kingdom, but they also have control of Finland. Now, Lutheran ideas sort of took hold among some noble elites and at first, and the rulers of all three countries introduced the Lutheran Reformation. These were, in all three cases, you know, kind of top-down Reformation, although, you know, there doesn't seem to be evidence, apart from in Iceland, when there was quite serious resistance as well as quite aggressive enforcement, there doesn't seem to have been huge amounts of resistance to Reformation. This may have something to do with the fact that it was the Lutheran Reformation, which had a lot more sort of exterior cultural similarity with Catholicism, the Calvinist version. But it may well also have something to do, of course, that you have to remember that Christianity was not really spreading in places like Norway and Sweden until the 11th century, or the late 10th at earliest. Whereas in somewhere like England, it had been around since the late 6th century and in, you know, and somewhat earlier even. So Catholicism, you would expect to be, you know, roughly twice as embedded in the popular culture of somewhere like England than in the culture of somewhere like Norway or Sweden. Catholic worship was prohibited as a consequence of the Lutheran Reformation. Some traditional Christian practices survived for quite a long time. In the Dutch United Provinces, or the Dutch Republic, were created essentially by a very long, like 80-year, but ultimately successful rebellion against the Habsburg Spanish rulers. And it finally sort of finally there was a kind of Concord Treaty which just firmly established the Dutch Republic in 1648, but it had, you know, been in effectual existence for decades before that. The British kingdoms, England and Wales, Wales gets lumped in with England, Scotland and Ireland, in all of these the reformations, both Protestant reformations and Catholic reformations, were quite bitterly contested. In England, you had a quite unusual, probably you had the most persecution on both sides. In England was also probably the most important state that turned Protestant. By most important, as in the sort of wealthiest, the most advanced in terms of government and state formation, and probably the one with like the most political clout. So the Netherlands. The Netherlands were small. They weren't a superpower, but they were of great economic importance and therefore quite wealthy. Again, the history is a patchwork, but by the mid-16th century, all of these Netherlands principalities are loosely united. And they have, by inheritance, they've come into the possession of Charles of Habsburg, who was also the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, and he was also King Charles I of Spain. So he's got a lot to manage. A revolt against Habsburg rule did not start entirely as a religious thing. It was also to do with the individual princes and principalities wanting more control and less central control. But it quickly gained a religious and confessional context, partly because obviously the Protestant beliefs were spreading and they had also been repressed quite heavily by the Habsburg government. There may have been up to 1,300 people executed by 1566 in the Netherlands. So, of course, the concomitantly heresy then became strongly linked with revolt in the minds of the Habsburg rulers, and they see it as treasonous. And you know, anyone who all Protestant groups are likely to be treasonous, and as well as obviously sending in an army, which became notorious under the Duke of Alva. The Habsburg set up the Council of Troubles, which was supposed to restore and enforce order. And over up to 1570, the Council of Troubles had sort of thousands of names of people who ought to be investigated, and up to 1,000 of those seem to have been executed. You know, partly as Protestants and partly as rebels. The 1566 Protestant groups actually took control of a number of towns, and you had the iconoclasm of 1566, where they... iconoclasm sounds like it's a sort of huge disorganised mob. It was actually quite focused and quite organised and quite purposeful, and they set about destroying religious images and Catholic religious furniture in all the churches in all of these cities, in order to establish Protestantism. The iconoclasm of 1566 didn't stick, as it were. Quite a few of these towns would later be regained by Catholics and become ultimately part of the Catholic Netherlands. I'll talk about him more later, but it's in the 1570s and 80s, at the height of the troubles and violence of the war, that Peter Opmeer wrote his Historia Martyrum Bataviae, which is a Catholic martyrology of Catholics who've been killed during those wars. 1609 to 1622 is important because at that point there was the 12-year truce between what were now asserting themselves as the United Provinces, that with the aim of breaking away permanently from Spanish rule, and the what had been called since 1579 the Union of Utrecht, which were the states that had stayed sort of loyal to the Habsburgs. It is interesting that although the war and the split along the Netherlands has confessional, it splits along confessional lines, but that can be overstated. So our Catholic martyrologist Opmeer, for example, when he made a will in 1593 in Delft, which was in the United Provinces bit of the Netherlands, actually cut two of his sons out of his will because they had crossed the border to Antwerp and had taken service under the Spanish crown. And as far as he was concerned, this was a betrayal of the homeland. So even though he was a Catholic, and he was definitely in the business of publicising Protestant violence against Catholics, he identified with his homeland in the United Provinces, and he was not necessarily, therefore, a Habsburg loyalist. 1648 is when the United Provinces finally become recognised as the Dutch Republic at the Peace of Westphalia, which was the end... tried to mark the end of the 30 Years' War across much of continental Europe. And the south remained the Habsburg Netherlands. They're called the Spanish Netherlands, except that then the Spanish Habsburgs and the Austrian Habsburgs are two different branches, and they basically split. And at that point, the Spanish Netherlands and then the Austrian Netherlands, because they're ruled by the Austria Habsburgs rather than the Spanish Habsburgs. Sorry about that. The Habsburgs just get everywhere. In the Dutch Republic, the Protestant provinces, as the Catholic provinces prescribe Protestantism, the Protestant provinces prescribe Catholicism. The interesting thing is, from the 1570s, when they took over various towns, they say, well, there's a freedom of conscience. You can identify yourself as a Catholic, and you don't have to go to Calvinist worship, but Catholic worship is illegal, which to Catholics is kind of cold comfort. So it's like, great, so I can be a Catholic, but I can't go to Mass. You know, thanks. During the 17th century, the Catholics developed, therefore, hidden churches, where it is a church, but it's got to look like a house on the outside, or it's got to be a chapel in someone's house. Their priests partly have a supply of priests from them, you know, training over the border in the southern Netherlands. So Catholics in the Dutch Netherlands can be sort of sustained by funding and training and schools and so on in the southern Catholic Netherlands. The priests were sometimes arrested, imprisoned, or banished. But over, generally, in the Dutch Republic, after the end of Syria, after sort of serious hostilities during the war, the persecution does not become lethal. And the thing is that although this is a Calvinist confessional state, the Catholics and other minorities are a substantial proportion of the population, and therefore basically the Dutch Republic always has to reckon with that, and it's always a Calvinist state but with large minorities who have to be in some way accommodated and negotiated with, and they in turn have to negotiate with basically existing while without disturbing too much, as it were, the official identity of the state as Calvinist. So the Catholics by no means the only minority in the Netherlands. There's also Lutherans and so on. To talk quickly about Peter Ottmeyer and his Historia Materum Batavia, sometimes some editions have called it Batavicorum. Batavia means the Netherlands, the Low Countries. Now, he seems to have written it during the 70s and 80s, but it's actually first published in print after his death in 1625. So it's a posthumous publication. That's just the title page from one of the earliest editions. He goes through and he names like some few dozen martyrs who got killed, deliberately in various circumstances by the Dutch Protestants. The 11, there is a group called the 11 Martyrs of Gorkum who feature in this, and they are only the best known, but that was in 1572. And it became a sort of fairly notorious event that a rebel commander had rounded up these 11 friars and had them all hanged after a very summary trial. But they are the best known, but they're not the only cases, and they're not by any means the only cases Ottmeyer is interested in. And they also have sort of various named people, and then he'll throw in a few others who are just kind of reports. He'll talk about some case like Cornelius Mies, and he's talking about Cornelius van Mies and his martyrdom, and then he goes, oh, and also in this town there were like three other priests that got thrown in a dung heap and died, so it's just this, he might not know their names, and we can't always track his sources, but the named martyrs are kind of the main event, and then there's also all these sort of other reports of stuff that happened, which is a little like Verstegen in a way. Now, the thing about, obviously, the Netherlands, the Catholic martyrs Ottmeyer talks about have in general been a lot less sort of known historically than the sort of many hundreds of Protestants that got killed in the course of the Netherlands War. And the point is, this is not like a numbers game, as though we can somehow morally evaluate Catholicism and Protestantism at an existential level by adding up numbers of stiffs in the 16th century in a particular place, which is unfortunately sort of what some historians have done. I think of Dermot McCulloch, he's obviously a very eminent historian, but there's a line, I recall a line in his Reformation Europe's House Divided where he just said, where Protestant crowns smashed statues, Catholic crowns killed people. Which is a kind of bald and generalised statement. But you can't sort of state that as though it's a constant distinction. Catholics kill people, Protestants smash statues, and then draw conclusions about Protestantism and Catholicism from this non-fact. I suppose the thing about looking at both sides of these martyrological traditions is just to say, don't do that. Avoid those generalisations and avoid evaluative conclusions drawn from those generalisations. In the British kingdoms, again, I'm going to have to run through this quick because we don't have time to do all of them in detail. In England and Wales, you have state-led reformations, monarch-led. The religion was basically every Tudor monarch after Henry VII, so four out of five of them, changed the religious settlement. How did anyone not study, like, the Tudors at some point during school? You never did it. Okay, good for you. There are lots of books you can catch up on. But so every single monarch, Henry VIII, Edward VI, Mary I, Elizabeth I, the Tudor monarchs, Henry's the dad, each one of his children in turn sits on the throne. None of them have children, hence end of the Tudor dynasty in 1603. Each one of them had a new religious settlement. Just flagging up the turning points, 1534 was Henry VIII's Act of Supremacy, when he declared the Church of England to be split off from the Church of Rome, and he declares that the Pope has no authority over the Church of England, but that he himself, as king, is head of the Church. Various Catholics who wouldn't go along with this got executed. Most people kind of did go along with it because Henry didn't actually change at this point any of the other beliefs and practices. He establishes this sort of Catholicism without the Pope, although it's debatable whether you can have that, but anyway. Then you have the changes of Edward VI's reign, where he goes for a much more, his advisors, he's only a child king, but his advisors go for a much more clearly Protestantism, much more Calvinist. No, it's not quite Calvinism, it's much more Calvinist. In 1553, Mary I comes to the throne, she restores Catholicism. This was probably, at this time, the majority of people in England were probably still Catholic rather than Protestant, so they were mostly supportive of this. The ones that weren't got quite heavily persecuted, to the tune of 286 executions by burning. In 1558, she died. Elizabeth I succeeded. 1559, you have the Elizabethan settlement, which is sort of a compromise because it tries to retain some of the ceremonies and a lot of the Catholic church structure. She retains bishops, for example, which a lot of Calvinist churches don't. But nevertheless, we have to be clear that the papal authority is completely repudiated. The Queen is the supreme governor, and the theology is basically Protestant, Calvinist, and not Catholic. Although she leaves room for ambiguity in the hopes that people who are still feeling, well, basically ambiguous will kind of thereby feel able to go along with it. So Catholic worship is outlawed at this point. The main anti-Catholic statutes, though, come in 1581 and 1585, and I'll talk about those later. In Scotland, again, the Reformation was kind of led by Protestants in Parliament and in the nobility. It was not led by a monarch. The Queen was Mary, Queen of Scots, who'd become Queen in 1542 as a baby, literally as a baby. So her mother, her French mother, was the Queen Regent. And so in the 1560s, you have this anomaly of a Catholic Queen, but a Protestant government. There was still obviously a strong Catholic faction. Some big nobles were Catholic and always wanted to reverse and overturn what the majority of the kind of political nation, if you like, had done. Catholic worship was prohibited. Although you didn't see, for some reason in Scotland, you didn't see the kind of wide-scale persecutions that you did in England. There seems to have been few actual executions on either side. There were two Catholics killed, known to us from the 1550s, and another one much later in 1615 under James I and VI. James I, after his mother was deposed, James I was put on the throne. When he grew up and took control, he liked to sort of keep them guessing policy. He didn't like the very strict Calvinists who had dominated him and his country during his childhood. But at some points the Catholic faction had great hopes of reversing the whole thing by either political or military means. This never really worked out for them, because James also wouldn't unequivocally side with them. So hopes of an official reversal were kind of dead by 1590. But Catholicism was able to get along in parts of the country. Partly because in England you have a somewhat weaker state. So, in Scotland the state is somewhat weaker, and so in a way, sort of widespread, lethal, if you like, enforcement of religious policy was much more difficult for a Scottish government than an English government, but also because you had some big, powerful nobles who remained Catholic. And so due to their patronage in areas of the country that they sort of controlled, Catholicism could survive and retreat, as it were, to those areas. In Ireland, the Reformation was imposed from England, because Ireland was essentially a colony. I mean, it just was. It was imposed from England. And the Protestant Reformation basically added a religious to a national conflict. Not only have you got, you know, England as the imperial power, really, and Ireland as the colony, but then the English are Protestant, the Irish are Catholic, so there's a religious conflict. There were multiple rebellions and multiple brutal suppressions in Ireland. Catholicism was prohibited, of course, but this was in a way only enforceable where the English government had actual power, and that was always contested. Interestingly, in Ireland, while in England there were no more Catholic bishops after 1559, after the sort of the ones around the 1559 sort of gradually die off, but in Ireland they always maintained, the Pope kept on appointing Catholic bishops. They never actually stopped, even though obviously they were always in a slightly precarious position. Okay, so I'm going to move on to look in a bit more detail at England, because actually it's the one I know best. And I think it's also a good one to study, because English Catholicism became somewhat important in the culture of the Catholic Reformation more generally. And so I think it's a good case study. Right, so as I said, 1559. The context for the English mission, what came to be called the English mission, which was English priests trained and ordained on the continent, going back to England to try and maintain Catholic communities and Catholicism in a Protestant state. They were mostly what's called secular priests, which means they're priests just ordained by a bishop. They're not part of a religious order. They're not monks, basically. But there were also Jesuits, the hot new kind of monk from the Counter-Reformation Society of Jesus. There were also later on various Benedictines, Dominicans, and even a few Franciscans. So this English mission, the context in which it launches is that, as we said, Catholicism's been illegal from 1559. In 1570, Elizabeth I had been excommunicated by the Pope Pius V and declared that she's an illegitimate monarch, and therefore Catholics don't have any moral obligation to be loyal to her. This basically morally legitimises rebellion for Catholics, which doesn't mean that they all want to rebel or can rebel, and also it doesn't mean, incidentally, that, like, you can assassinate Elizabeth, and that's fine, because if you assassinate Elizabeth, that wouldn't be treason, but it would still be murder. So you'd still have to square that. In 1571, there's an act passed that made it treason to call the Queen a heretic or schismatic, and I do actually know of two executions under that particular statute, or to receive any bull, so any kind of official document at all, from the Pope. This is coming off the back of the actual bull excommunicating Elizabeth and declaring that she's, like, not a real monarch, which, obviously, as a monarch, you wouldn't want circulating around your kingdom. But it's extended and actually covers any official papal document at all. In 1581, it becomes officially defined as treason to convert to Catholicism, which is called being reconciled, or to reconcile anyone. There also the fine for refusing to attend Protestant worship, which a lot, not all, but a lot of Catholics felt obliged to refuse to attend Protestant worship, was increased to £20 a month. 1585, this was the big lethal one, really, was made treason for an Englishman ordained as a Catholic priest to be in England, to enter England. And you could also get hanged for harbouring or assisting a priest. And it was that act that was responsible, well, the 1581 as well, but most of the 133 priests that were executed from 1585 to 1603, and then also another 60-odd lay people, most of those were executed under the 1585 Act. After Queen Elizabeth's death, executions got a lot more frequent, but under James I, he was the King of Scotland, and he then inherited the Crown of England as well. Some sort of executions did continue from about 1604 on. And that's because in 1604, James I, much to the chagrin of English Catholics, who many of them had been really hoping that they were going to get more favour from James, so much to their chagrin, the new King James I confirms all the above Elizabethan statutes in 1604. This may possibly have been a causal factor in Robert Catesby and his friends, including Guy Fawkes, sort of going ahead with the infamous gunpowder plot, the attempted mass assassination of the entire political class. Okay, so I'm going to look at some figures from the what you might call the English Counter-Reformation, and sort of try and put them in context. We kind of have to talk about him because he's sort of become a bit iconic in Elizabethan Catholic studies. So you have to mention him. He arguably wasn't the most important or most influential missionary in terms of what he actually did or what he actually wrote or what he actually organised, but he's become sort of emblematic. He was born in London in 1540 and he's executed in London in 1581. But in between, of course, Catholic has become, well, 1540, since he was born, it's been Henrician, it's become Protestant, it's become Catholic again, and then it's become Protestant again. Cambion has grown up with all these changes, but in about 1570 he sort of seems to have finally decided that he doesn't believe in the Protestant Church, that the Catholicism is the true religion, and therefore he actually leaves Oxford, where he had been a scholar and a fellow of St John's College. He spent some time in Ireland first, mostly among Catholic, Anglo-Irish Catholic gentry figures. But then he heads off to become a Jesuit, and he works in Prague, which is a place where, at this time, the Jesuits are working really hard to try and re-establish Catholicism and promote it. I think Prague, at the time, had a policy of toleration, so the Catholics don't have a kind of monopoly. But they do have a lot of promotion from the rulers. So there were Cambion becomes part of the Counter-Reformation in Bohemia. But in 1580, the Jesuits and the Pope decide that they're going to send a mission to England. There have been English priests secretly coming back to England since 1574. But the Jesuits decide to send a mission there in 1580, and Cambion's told, "You're it. You've got to stop lecturing on philosophy in Prague and start, travelling the English shires in disguise and saying secret masses." And there is some evidence that Cambion was personally would much rather have carried on teaching in Prague, being alive, but he was bound by his vow to do what he was told. While he was in England, on the run, he wrote a book in defence of Catholic theology called The Rationis Dei and 10 Reasons, which he calls 10 Reasons in Defence of Catholicism. And what's interesting about this is, in 1584, so after Cambion has been caught and executed, this book appears in Polish, a translation by Wilkowski. And Wilkowski translated it because he reads this English work and he sees it as a tool in the Counter-Reformation in Poland, which we talked about a little bit last week. Cambion's martyrdom, which was known about all over Europe, was eulogised a mere 7 years later in 1588, which is also the year of the Spanish Armada, when Catholic Spain decides to try and solve this problem of persecution of Catholics in the completest possible way. Although it didn't go quite right for them, and the interesting thing is that this is eulogised in a Spanish poem that was written in Peru. So Cambion is in a way emblematic of how the Counter-Reformation can travel. You have this Englishman who worked in Prague, was executed in London, and his martyrdom and his, well, both his sort of defense of Catholicism and his martyrdom are being celebrated and eulogized as far apart as Poland and Peru. And in a sense, that is speaks to the global Catholic Reformation and also, of course, the effective global networks of the Jesuits. I have to be quick on these last two. I wanted to talk about Richard Holtby. I could have talked about many other people, but I'm talking about Holtby because he's fun. He, if you like, was a more successful missionary than Campion, because having gone abroad, as one did, to do his training, he returns to the English mission in 79, takes a short break in the 80s. That was actually quite a good time to take a break from the English mission to become a Jesuit. But from about 1590 to 1640, he is like managing Catholic networks in the north of England. He's managing priests landing. He's telling them where to go to the safe houses. He's just making sure that the mission is funded, that people, priests have money to live on. His work seems to have included actually creating hiding places, which there is a, this is a, an example not that Holtby created, but from Worcestershire in Harvington Hall, hiding places that you can basically run and hide in when the Elizabethan equivalent of the police turn up. The other picture is of a chalice from about the 1630s, which is made, you can't see it in the picture, but it's been made so that you can actually unscrew it, unscrews into three pieces, which can then be put together so the whole thing is really small and you can shove it in a hiding place. It's a clandestine chalice. Holtby, I greatly admire because he was never ever captured. He wasn't martyred because he wasn't ever caught. He did, however, he is actually important because he's the source of a number of our most important manuscript primary sources for Elizabethan Catholicism because he wrote various accounts of his experience on the mission and also the martyrdom of various other priests who were less good at evading capture than him. My last English Catholic, I'd like you to just think back to Japan and what we said about Naito Julia. Because the interesting thing about Mary Ward is that she, and I'm not saying there was conscious cross influence, but there's, it's interesting that something similar happens. Mary Ward was doing something a little bit similar, but rather more ambitious than Naito Julia. She wanted to start a group of religious women, Catholic women, who would live in community as religious, but who would not be cloistered. They would not be nuns. They would teach, they would educate, and also she wanted them to be missionary, like the Jesuits, although not priests, of course. As some of her people did indeed work clandestinely as catechists on the English mission for a couple of decades. But she doesn't, however, only work in England. They established numerous schools across the continent. She works hard to gain papal approbation, but ultimately her critics win. And the Institute was suppressed by Papal Bull. And they said, no, sorry, what these women are doing is not what we want. They came up with sort of various allegations, which were ultimately allegations about the life these women were living was just not seemly and fitting for Catholic religious women. And that it was, in, you know, they didn't claim that they were actually doing anything specifically wrong, but this whole project was just not conducive to proper roles for women and men. But on the other hand, it's interesting that the Pope at the time, Urban VIII, was not personally against Mary Ward because only a year later, after she, you know, she petitioned him, and he gave her he authorized her to carry on living and working with a small group of her followers in Rome and to run a school. And some various of our other houses also survived, basically by reopening as just schools run by women who happen to be all Catholic and living together and praying together and not marrying, you know. But by not officially being a religious order, they were able to continue their work. I mean, perhaps the reason why Mary Ward was disapproved and not allowed to establish an official religious order until 1877, so, you know, 2.5 centuries her successors kept plugging away at this, was perhaps because, one, the Pope never heard about Naito Julia. She was one woman and one group in Tokyo. And two, Mary was establishing So Nata Julia and her supporters never sought official approbation to be a religious order. They just did what they did sort of unobtrusively and without making any huge claims. And so they were kind of allowed to get on with it. Also, Mary Ward was trying to do something much more ambitious. She wanted to found an official religious order. She wanted there to be multiple houses, multiple groups. She wanted it, crucially, to be, because it, she wanted it to be international, it was going to be self-governing. So most convents, you have your abbess, and the abbess, not on a day-to-day basis, but ultimately the arbiter is the local bishop, as just as he is of, you know, everything else that goes on in his diocese. But if you have an international order like the Jesuits or the Dominicans, then the superior general of the order is ultimately answerable directly to the Pope, and a local bishop has less control over that religious order in a particular location. And Mary Ward was proposing that for an order of women, which I think was what was seen as sort of not acceptable by the church authorities of the day. So Mary Ward was frustrated and yet you know, ultimately not an entire failure, because she left a legacy that was able to sort of achieve what she wanted much, much later. And I think it's interesting that in Japan and England, two states in some ways very unlike, but with these some similarities in the situation that, like, you know, Catholic groups found themselves in, you have, and I'm not, you know, the historian of Naito Naruko, Nawata Ward, sort of pointed this out, you have two women coming up with a sort of similar project, and a project that would probably, that, you know, would probably not have been conceived of in a Catholic state, in a situation where Catholicism was not prescribed. So I think, I suppose the take home from this is, first of all, that we need to see England as an arm of the global Catholic Reformation. It was regarded as a kind of cottage industry of, you know, like, sort of talking about English martyrs and finding priest holes for a long time. But it's got to be thought of as an arm of the global Catholic Reformation, and also as a case study in confessionalisation and the confessional state, along with other states, Protestant and Catholic, across the whole of post-Reformation Europe. Okay, thank you.